The top two Republican candidates in Florida's governor's race meet here in Jacksonville for their final debate before the primary. Did it change anybody's mind? We'll take a closer look this morning. And good morning. We are live from Studio 5 for First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, Adam Putnam and Ron DeSantis met at JU last night for their final debate before the voters go to the polls at the end of the month. Was the debate all about nothing, as one candidate said, or were real issues discussed? Give us a call with your thoughts about the governor's race at 549-2937. Then later, we've got a strong economy right now. How is it impacting this city's African-American-owned businesses? Our latest edition of Real Talk takes a look at that. Plus, this week is National Farmers Market Week. We've got some ideas of great places you can go to get fresh produce for a good price and how that's helping build healthier communities, too. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, Adam Putnam and Ron DeSantis slugged it out last night in a televised debate on the JU campus. Lots of one-liners in this go-round, including Putnam, our agriculture commissioner, calling Congressman DeSantis the Seinfeld candidate. More about that in a moment. But since the two candidates agree on most issues, did the debate change the calculus of this race just before the August 28th primary? And what about the fact that the Democrats' candidates for governor will be meeting tonight on the JU campus as well? Lots to discuss as we welcome the mastermind behind it all, Rick Mullady. He heads up JU's Public Policy Institute. They sponsored last night's debate along with our partner WJXT Channel 4. Rick, good to see you.
Great to be here.
And also here with his thoughts, our regular political analyst, Daniel Cronrath of FSCJ. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
And give us a call. Have you made up your mind when it comes to the governor's race? Who will get your vote? Did you watch the debate last night on Channel 4? By the way, we carried a simulcast live here on 89.9. Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to First Coast Connect at wjct.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax. And so let's begin with the notion that going into this debate, there was no love lost, Rick, between these two candidates, and it showed on stage, some fiery exchanges.
There clearly were some fiery exchanges, but I don't know if it's so much of personal dynamics as the fact that the stakes are high and the time is short. Early voting starts Monday. The election's 2 weeks from Tuesday. For Adam Putnam in particular, he recognized that there's been a shift, a pretty significant one, that Ron DeSantis now has the lead. He has the momentum. And he needed to sort of stop the bleeding and reset and to change the trajectory of this race. And so it wasn't surprising that he came out and both defined himself and was very aggressive in his criticism and his attacks on Ron DeSantis.
Putnam really fired off some one-liners and zingers in his effort to define DeSantis negatively in the minds of GOP primary voters. Let's listen to this little clip from Putnam talking about DeSantis.
Lately, however, it has felt a lot like I'm running against the Seinfeld candidate. The campaign's being run out of a studio. They have a smattering of celebrity guest appearances. And at the end of the day, it's all about nothing. But unlike Seinfeld, it's not funny. And Floridians deserve better than to have a candidate who makes it all about themselves and not about the future of Florida.
So Putnam's saying Ron DeSantis is a guy who's about nothing. That was a pretty tough insult. How do you think DeSantis took that, and how do you think it played in the audience?
Well, as far as how DeSantis took it, I thought that each candidate was probably at their strength when they were being aggressive. Ron DeSantis's response is sort of threefold. I got the Trump endorsement. You expect him to play that card. I'm a vet in Iraq. He played that card. And then he'd go on offense, and he would attack Adam Putnam on, for example, contributions from Big Sugar. That would be the Santis model, and that's a formula that's worked well for him. But, Melissa, I thought you got it exactly right. The attempt to define Ron DeSantis in the eyes of those voters, he was trying Adam Putnam in a memorable way to try to define Ron DeSantis as a Washington person focused on Washington who really as he would claim, nothing there when it comes to a plan for Florida, and that you should cast your vote for the person who's got depth and cares about the issues in Florida.
It's 549-2937. Give us a call with your thoughts on the governor's race. Here's DeSantis talking about his campaign.
We have a great opportunity to build off the success that we've enjoyed under Governor Rick Scott's leadership. We can have an economy that is the envy of the country. If we keep taxes low, if we keep regulations reasonable, and if we rein in our out-of-control litigation climate, we can reform education by ending Common Core, expanding parental choice, and getting the U.S. Constitution back in the classroom in a very big way.
Okay. Daniel Cronrath, a regular political contributor here on the show. Ron DeSantis has pulled away in the polls. He has run a campaign so completely differently than most candidates for governor do. Campaigning, we heard about where he stands on the issues just there, but the campaign has, to a great extent, been about the endorsement by President Trump, regular appearances on Fox News, and really a lot of money coming in from out of state for Congressman DeSantis. Although, as he pointed out, Adam Putnam controversially is taking money from a controversial donor in Florida, Big Sugar. So for DeSantis, this unconventional campaign strategy has been working for him. And let's talk about the dynamics driving that.
Yeah, I think what you're seeing him do, Congressman DeSantis, is basically do a Donald Trump 2.0 relative to how he's running his campaign here in Florida. And I think he's doing it to a lot of success. I think, will this strategy work in a general election? Clearly not. But right now, in terms of what he's doing, he's engaging the majority of Republican primary voters do watch Fox, and he's getting a very sympathetic audience when he goes on Fox. So to a certain extent, I think while we in the media or we in academia can be critical of him for not expanding his audience, you have to ask the question at the end of the day, why would he? This is a formula which is working out very well for him. It's working in the polls for him. And I think that, you know, that is typically where he does his best is when he, as Rick suggested earlier, when he is on point and he's able to keep his focus, and basically remind folks that, especially in a Republican primary, that he is the choice of Donald Trump. And, Donald Trump is somebody, I mean, let's not forget just two short years ago, Marco Rubio is a very, very popular statewide figure. And, you know, Donald Trump cleaned his clock in the primary here in Florida. So there's a lot of, there's a lot of wisdom behind his strategy, Melissa.
It's 549-2937. Are you registered to vote? Who will get your vote in the Florida governor's race? Today, we're talking about last night's Republican debate at JU. The Democrats are meeting on the JU campus tonight. It's 549-2937 as we talk politics with Rick Mullaney of JU, Daniel Cronrath of FSCJ. Okay, so Rick, as Daniel pointed out, for DeSantis, he's running the kind of primary campaign that is micro-targeted to appeal to GOP primary voters. They love President Trump. He has 88% approval with primary voters on the GOP side. Let's assume DeSantis becomes the nominee. How does he pivot to the center after this primary in this swing state when he's going to be facing a different electorate?
It's a great question, and it'll be a real challenge because the DeSantis strategy is very much a primary strategy. And that is a primary strategy that says, what can I do to win the Republican primary, which means a move to the right and a full embrace of Donald Trump. And with that
ad, what about the television ad that he did where he's teaching his kid how to build a wall with Legos or blocks? Well, what did you think of that ad?
Well, let's talk about that ad and let's talk about the Democrats and compare the two, because what you see on the Democratic side, particularly with Jeff Green, is a full attack on Donald Trump. And so you're going to see this clash. I mean, the five Democratic candidates are in unity on the attack on Donald Trump. Ron DeSantis, full embrace. And I think the ad, quite frankly, may serve him well in the primary. It's also the kind of ad you could see Democrats using in the general and to fire up their groups. The challenge for Ron DeSantis, I think, is that independent voter and the broader demographics will be a challenge in the general. And therefore, he's going to have huge turnout from his core support, mm-hmm. and he's going to have to hope that the Democratic side is not energized. Because if they turn out, it will be a challenge in the general election with this Republican, with this Republican primary strategy.
And let's talk about the strategy now for the Democrats. JU's Public Policy Institute tonight is hosting not a debate, but a forum, right, for the five Democratic candidates. And so I'm just curious, why a forum, not a debate? They've debated before, the five of them.
They've had five prior debates. And this will
they're debated out.
Well, there's that. I also think it gives an opportunity to go maybe a little bit. It's a short period of time with five candidates in just 1 hour. But since it's one-on-one five times, you can do some follow-up questions. You can go a little bit more in depth. You saw some of this last night, particularly like on guns, where the candidates were articulate but actually non-responsive to the real issue. Because sometimes if you ask a tough question, they will go to the part that their strength as opposed to what the question's asking for. So I think tonight will be a nice opportunity to see all five Democratic candidates, maybe go and wish it was a longer interview, but at least to see in this format, go a little bit more in depth than you would get in a debate format.
And Channel 4 will carry that tonight. We'll simulcast it as well here on 89.9. Okay, so Daniel Cronrath, the five Democrats, and the narrative that has sort of emerged is that as former Congresswoman Gwen Graham pulls away in the polls, it's Gwen and the men, Gwen Graham and four guys up there on the stage. The men in the race have struggled to pull up, you know, away from the pack and differentiate themselves in the minds of Democratic primary voters. So Gwen Graham poised to win this primary as of right now. You know, what are your thoughts about the Democratic field as we get closer to August 28th?
Sure. I think that Gwen and the men kind of statement that you just put out there is something that their campaign has been working on putting out there as well. And I think to a certain degree, you've seen a lot of pushback in the Democratic primary or the Democratic debates, which have taken place so far, with Gwen Graham and her surrogates pushing back against criticisms of her. And, you know, whether it be Andrew Gillum or whether it be Philip Levine, a lot of pushback that they've been engaging in you know, dirty politics. I think that if I'm a Democratic candidate and I watched the debate last night at JU and I saw the candor with which both of those candidates went after each other, I think that should be a preview for what the general election would look like. And if I'm the Democratic candidates tonight, all four of the men and not Gwen Graham, I would be prepared to say, is Gwen Graham the kind of candidate who is going to be able to engage in a vitriolic debate and a heated debate about the future of Florida come the general election this fall? And you know, I would say that Congresswoman Graham has a lot of strengths. I don't know thus far in the debate season, if being somebody who can stand on a stage and really get into a slugfest with another candidate is something which she's acquitted herself particularly well. Whereas some of the other candidates, like you said before, like Jeff Green and Philip Levine, they almost relish that kind of debate because that's where their strengths are.
Rick.
Yes.
What do you think about what Daniel said?
There's a lot of truth in that, but let me say this for the general. We tend to think that everything stops and the whole state tunes in to watch the debate. And I don't think
they don't.
And so if, in fact, it's Gwen and this is a long way to go, I mean, it's 2 weeks away, but it's a very competitive field. I do think this has been very strategic and she has some advantages. The Gwen and the men framing is effective for her. She is the only female in the race. Her father's a Florida icon. She beat a Republican in a Republican-leaning district, and she does that effectively. I do think that in the general election, it'll be about more than just the debates, and her somewhat more moderate voting record in Congress, for example, will serve her well in the general. I think she'd be very formidable. I do agree, however, that in a slugfest, it'll be maybe a little bit challenging, and she will have to be challenged to hold her own in that kind of context.
All right, and let's go to some calls now as we continue talking with Rick Mullaney, who heads up JU's Public Policy Institute. Also, you can catch his show Policy Matters here on 89.9 and Daniel Cronrath of FSCJ, 549-2937. We're talking politics this morning. What are the biggest issues for you in the Florida governor's race? Chuck at the Beaches. Hi, Chuck. Good morning.
Hello, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I'm most likely, under most circumstances, will vote Republican for the governor. However, I have to say I was very, very disappointed with their response to the question, is healthcare a right? It may not necessarily be a right, but, you know, you have to care more about your neighbor and you have to care more about people's health than you do about bridges. I just noticed on the news that the woman who played the lead character in Superman was ruled
Margot Kidder.
She ruled a suicide.
Yeah, Lois Lane.
So we have huge numbers of people dealing with bipolar disease and depression and drug addiction, and our prisons are our mental health. That's where we're dealing with that. And the idea that they could act like this is, they would rather spend the money on bridges and roads than dealing with the tens of thousands of people that are having difficulties with health insurance. I care more about my neighbor. I care more about their health than I care about bridges. So that's what I thought.
All right, Chuck, thanks for that. You know, there's a comment on our Facebook page about this issue too. Josh writes, Adam Putnam, when asked if healthcare is a right for all, responded, it is not. In a state with millions of uninsured people and older people in need of life-preserving care, Florida needs a governor who's going to promote healthcare for everyone, regardless of their age or socioeconomic status. A healthy state, he says, is an economically productive state. Okay, heading into the general election, is this going to be a winning issue for the Democrats in a state where we've got a lot of seniors? The Democrats in the primary field have been hitting this issue very hard, talking about the Affordable Care Act, talking about the need to extend health care to all. How does this play out in the general election? Is this a winning issue for the Democrats
or not? Well, 2 points. First of all, I would draw a distinction between fundamental right and whether that means you're opposed to promoting health care. Those are not the same whatsoever. Mm-hmm. You can still be very, very strong in seeking to cover 800,000 uninsured that have fallen in the gap. And it's not a question of roads versus health care. But that issue of fundamental right is actually a technical legal one. If something does become a fundamental right, for example, under the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause, then you get into the issue, just as you saw with gay marriage, is this a constitutional right? And then is it therefore mandated? So you get into separate issues on this fundamental right question, but I think the question is a really good one from our caller, because that was one of the parts of the debates. Neither candidate said it was a fundamental right or a right, which contrasts with Bernie Sanders. And the answer to your question, I would give the edge to Democrats on this issue. This is an issue in which Democrats take the position, of course, a more compassionate position about health care for all and how you get there. Now, there's a price tag, and right, that price tag tends to get ignored in the compassionate conversation. And remember this, and Kent Justice brought it out last night. You look at the $89 billion budget in the state of Florida, the biggest item is healthcare, over $30 billion to Medicaid alone. So it's not as though there's not a commitment, but I do think advantage slightly to the Democrats on that issue.
And Chuck, I think the other thing that if I were Commissioner Putnam, I think, which is an easy pivot, is differentiating the fact that healthcare as a right and healthcare access are two different things entirely. And I think a Republican candidate running in a general election can say, listen, I'm not unsympathetic to the plight of my neighbor. I'm not unsympathetic to the plight of folks who are less fortunate, who I go to church with or I worship with, whatever the case may be. And I believe that they should have access to healthcare, which is affordable. I don't believe that they're entitled to healthcare, which is free or something that would differentiate them from the Democratic candidates in the fall. And I think it's an important distinction.
All right. And Marilyn down in Palm Coast emails the show. My husband and I switched parties from non-affiliated voter to Republican just so we could vote against Trump DeSantis. I guess that's her pejorative nickname for Ron DeSantis. After the election, we will switch back to non-affiliated.
You know, it's one of the interesting things about being in Florida is that we are a closed primary state. And for a lot of the folks, or I think a third of the electorate right now who likes to be NPA or no party affiliation, one of the things being in a closed primary state that you do not have the ability to do is vote in a primary. I know a lot of my Democratic friends here in town who actually switched and registered Republican prior to the election for district attorney here in Jacksonville, if you'll recall, when Angela Corey. And a lot of those folks still haven't switched back yet.
Yeah, I mean, a third of the state is NPA, no party affiliation, which means these primaries are being decided by a relatively small pool of voters. And so totally different electorate than what we're going to see after August.
There's no doubt about it. First of all, the turnout is low. And then you take a look at who's in that turnout. And as much as Maryland represents a vote, let's say, for Adam Putnam, that does not represent a pathway to winning for him.
He's not going to get through the primary there aren't enough Marylands.
There aren't enough of those to get you there. And so the core support for Ron DeSantis in the Republican primary is identifiable and is affected by that Trump endorsement. There will be some like her who take a look at him in that endorsement, they feel so strongly they go the other way. But net, in the Republican primary, it's a difference maker that favors Ron DeSantis. Sure.
And not to get campaign wonky here either, but I think at the end of the day, the GOTV operation for Commissioner Putnam is going to be huge. It's really going to be making sure that his identified voter, the folks that identify with him, are getting out to vote, because the DeSantis vote may be, in fact, in a primary, a more casual one, even though there's a lot of support out there. A good campaign at the operation at the end of the day, a good ground game, could really help Commissioner Putnam.
Richard in Riverside. Richard, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I know we're coming up on the end of the segment, but I really would love for you, your guests, to just make a very clear distinction that NPA is not a political party. It's not an independent party. NPA literally means I choose not to be part of anybody's party. And what the problem is, because of the two-party system since 1877, we've been forced to push the voters into two directions, right-wing, left-wing, conservative, and both of them benefit the extremely rich, extremely white male. In the middle is someone like me, that I will vote for anybody who earns my vote, and therefore I will remain unaffiliated with anybody. The problem is the law removes my constitutional right to vote and tells me I must choose a party, and we need to change that. But until then, no party affiliation means you don't know how I'm going to vote, so why don't you just talk to me, tell me what you stand for, and you just might earn my vote.
Yeah, Richard, so many Floridians just like you. He really expressed that. Wow. Thanks for that call, Richard. It's the Richards that will be in play after the primary. Let's talk really quickly now about tonight's event, Rick. The Democrats will meet on stage at JU for an hour-long televised forum. They'll be talking to their base, the Democratic base. But going beyond this really important series you've put together this week in Jacksonville, in a few weeks, everything pivots to the general election. I'd love to get both of your thoughts about that.
About the general election itself?
Yeah.
Well, obviously, it's going to depend on who emerges from the Republican side and who emerges from the Democratic side. I think Dan made a great point earlier. The Adam Putnam hope is that the organization he's built out, and that his ground game and that his get out the vote effort, can make the difference with a low turnout a week from Tuesday. Other than that, you'd have to say at this point, advantage Ron DeSantis. And with the polling, it looks like he will be the Republican nominee. Not for sure, but that looks like he's the nominee. Mm-hmm. On the Democratic side, it's a close race. It's very competitive at the moment. Gwen Graham does have that lead, and she has a lot of good things going for her. But the top three include Philip Levine and Jeff Green. The dynamics of the general election are different depending on who emerges from that group. But if it is Gwen Graham, I do think that matchup, a lot will play out, but many pundits would tell you they think there's maybe a slight edge to Gwen there because of her appeal to independents, because of her more moderate voting record. And of course, she enjoys the brand name of her father. I mean, that's a strong brand in Florida.
And a lot of women
in the state
will probably be motivated to vote for her.
But remember, a lot to happen between now and November 6th.
Daniel.
I think that assuming that Gwen Graham is the nominee of the Democratic Party, I would say that if I were a Republican trying to field a candidate who would be most competitive against her, I think that the choice would be Commissioner Putnam. I think that in a general election right now, I think where Congressman DeSantis' strategy in the primary has served him extremely well. I think in the general election, he would find himself very, very isolated. As you mentioned before about the commercial, I don't know of a Democratic voter who's not going to be very motivated to vote by a man who puts out an ad where he's playing with wall blocks on his living room floor, building a wall with his child. So I think that come the general election, if Gwen Graham is the candidate, relative to tonight's debate at JU, this is the last chance for these four Democratic men on stage. I mean, much like we saw last night with Adam Putnam, I think he came out swinging. He had nothing to lose at this point in this race. And I think tonight that you may see
some more fireworks.
We very well may.
Well, make sure to catch it on our news partner, WJXT Channel 4, tonight at 8. It is competing against the Jaguars preseason game. But you know what? You can watch it because it's important. It's only the preseason. And you can listen to it on 89.9. We're going to simulcast it. And kudos to you, Rick Mullaney, for executing all of this. Rick heads up the JU Public Policy Institute. Thanks for being here.
One last comment. I would like to comment Kent Justice in particular, who I thought did an extraordinary
job. And moderator Kent Justice.
And Channel 4, I thought they did an extraordinary job.
Yes, they did. And Daniel Cronrath, thanks for being here as well. Thanks, guys. All right. Much more still ahead later. Some ideas for your weekend. Also, Real Talk and African-American-owned businesses in Jacksonville. We'll be right back.
WJCT's Jaguars Season Parking is still available. Be part of the coolest tailgating downtown. Includes paved space and indoor bathroom access. Contact Holly Manuel at 358-6311 or log on to wjct.org/parking. Reserve your space today.
Join WJCT, Baptist Health, and She Is Fierce for a Day for Her VIP opening night. Featuring Nicole Thomas, president of Baptist Medical Center South, Friday, August 17th at 6 p.m. at Jacksonville Main Library. The evening includes cocktails, connections, inspiration, an original art exhibit, and the chance to meet NBC Today Show style editor Bobby Thomas. For tickets, go to wjct.org/events.
I'm Christopher Kimball from Milk Street Radio. This week, I get a lesson in cuts of meat from Erica Nakamura and Jocelyn Guest. They help us decide what to buy, including inexpensive cuts that most consumers know nothing about. Also on this week's show, we travel to Armenia for barbecue, and we get a firsthand lesson in making great pork chops. Dr. Aaron Carroll weighs in on junk food taxes. All that coming up this week on Milk Street Radio from PRX.
Sunday morning at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, our economy is moving forward, and Jacksonville is getting lots of attention as a great place to do business and enjoy a good quality of life. So how are our local African-American-owned businesses doing in this strong economy? That's the subject of our Real Talk today with host Charles Griggs. His guests, Suzanne Pickett, Executive Director of the Jacksonville Cultural Development Corporation, Ronnie King, CEO of the software company Scratchwork, Jeffrey Ann Wilder, research scientist with the National Center for Women and IT, and Dane Gray, president of Elite Parking Services. Take a listen.
Suzanne Pickett, where have we come with Black-owned businesses? And what do you think is the reason why they are so non-relevant here in Jacksonville?
So from my experience, I'm a counselor of small businesses. I teach entrepreneurship and financials. And we have several businesses that are, you know, thriving and making money. The issue is that the businesses aren't reporting their income. You know, all the data comes from the reporting of the income to determine in the, which demographics are bringing in revenue from their businesses. And our businesses are not accurately reporting the income that they make.
So Dane, do you think that's accurate? Were you able to, as you move forward with your business, how did you grow into a sustainable operation?
Well, I think the first thing is to establish accountability for yourself. I don't think any person should be the begin-all, end-all. There should be someone that can help you maintain the course and then put together a good plan and, you know, provide a service that someone needs. A service or a product or a good that someone actually needs is important. The market will always tell you what they really feel about what you're providing. And I think that's important when we go about looking at businesses as a whole.
So, Ronnie, why is it important for Black-owned businesses to be successful in Jacksonville?
I mean, it's just important from an economic perspective. You know, when we think about Black-owned businesses, a lot of times I think about just overall wealth in general. You know, when I look at these numbers and some of the numbers that you talked about earlier, the ability to take risks and ability to capitalize on those risks are very important. And so We need more African Americans in our community that can afford to take those risks and benefit from them.
Yeah, so one of the important factors is that the difference between the disparity between the values of businesses, white-owned businesses in Jacksonville, the average value of those businesses are $572,000, where if you're a black-owned business person, the average value is only $32,000. Dr. Wilder, what do you think the impact of those numbers and the disparity on our community has and as it relates to providing jobs and a better economic impact?
Well, the gap isn't surprising to me. So as a social scientist, I already recognize that there is a huge gap when it comes to wealth between blacks and whites, and that historically has always been that way. And what we've seen just over the past 10 years is that that wealth gap is not closing. It's actually getting wider. So the gulf is becoming wider. Here's the other thing, though. You know, blacks in general have access to $1.2 trillion in spending power. So it's not that the opportunity isn't there, right? The potential's there. The capability is there. I think that there, and again, I'm not a business owner. I am a patron of as many black-owned businesses as I possibly can. But I do think just from a sociological perspective, there has just been, of course, a systemic history of black people being locked out of opportunities. And I think that this presents a really great platform for change and for transformation.
There used to be a time when we could count on black-owned businesses to come to the rescue and partner with churches and other civic community organizations to, you know, to provide opportunities where there was none across the community, and they would be pillars of the community to provide a stable foundation for growing communities.
And I think that's one of the wonderful things about Jacksonville. We've seen that in Jacksonville's history. But, you know, as many things that the civil rights movement has brought us, unfortunately, integration ripped that apart, ripped away the base, the black business base, if you will, within the cities, within Jacksonville and other cities as well. So as great as integration was, that was sort of the sort of residual impact of that.
So one of the challenges that I've had is trying to retrieve data on how successful black-owned businesses here in Jacksonville are, or just to provide a landscape for what's actually happening. And what we found is that that type of data is not available, currently not available. Suzanne, what type of barrier does that provide? How does that hurt the growth of black-owned business? We don't really understand where we sit and what kind of successes are actually or challenges are going on out there.
Well, when you have organizations that are coming into Jacksonville, large companies, for example, they have government contracts that may have to, you know, a stipulation of their government contract is that they may have to use a minority contractor and expand. And without that data, you know, it's a challenge for them to find those minority contractors and offer those opportunities.
So I know that you mentioned that a lot of the companies are not reporting regarding their numbers, their success, their sales. And so that's going to have an impact on how companies do business here and locally?
It does have an impact. When clients come to me and they want to generate assets, you know, they want to get a loan for their business, or they are wanting to purchase a home. If you're self-employed, you know, you need your 2 years tax returns, you need your profit and loss statement. The majority of the community that I've come in contact with at the Urban League and, you know, in the community, they don't have that information, and they're not being provided the knowledge how to access that information.
So another one of the data points that I wanted to discuss, because this has been fascinating, is that the majority, or about 95% of the black-owned businesses, are pretty much sole proprietor or run by one person. Mm-hmm. And what we like to believe is that black-owned businesses would be the catalyst for job growth and development. So Dane or Ronnie, where does the opportunity lie for growing businesses to put them in a better position to hire more people?
Well, I mean, I think it comes down to more money, right? More sales. You know, but when I look at those numbers, and I think you said it was 95% or whatever it was, mm-hmm. that's just one owner. You know, and I don't know what those businesses are doing in terms of numbers, but, you know, a lot of times that pretty much signals those are businesses just in almost name only sometimes, you know, and until we can get to the point where we can actually employ other people, A lot of times, you know, that's where that growth opportunity lays. You know, we have to be in a position where we can hire people in our community. We know we have an unemployment issue in the Black community. And so making sure we put businesses, especially Black businesses, in those positions to hire is important. And that comes with, you know, what he said earlier in terms of sales and having a product that you can market and growth.
We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank our guests and for today's lively discussion on this edition of Real Talk. Suzanne Pickett, Dr. Jeffrey Ann Wilder, Dane Gray, and Ronnie King, thank you all for being here. And we look forward to our next discussion on Real Talk.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And we'll be right back.
I'm David Luckin, inviting you to listen to the Electro Lounge for the best down-tempo and new jazz at 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday nights, only on 89.9 FM, WJCT.
Welcome back. The U.S. Department of Agriculture just released a proclamation making this week National Farmers Market Week. Yeah, the goal here is to increase awareness of the vital role local farmers markets play in creating healthy communities. Brittany Norris is with DIG Local Network. They have relationships with several farmers markets around town. She's here now to tell all of us why we need to visit our neighborhood farmers market this week. Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Now, there are farmers markets to choose from. There's Riverside Arts Market. There's the Beaver Street Market over just west of downtown, the oldest one in Florida. There are farmers markets at the beaches.
Yes,
You've got your pick.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, Edible Magazine just released a really good article with a full list of basically farmers markets in our area. So yeah, there's quite a few to choose from.
And why is it important to have a week set aside, do you think, to really promote farmers markets?
I think as Americans, we quickly forget our connection to food. We don't know who's producing our food. We don't know where it's coming from. We don't realize, even I think the tomato is a really good example. A lot of tomatoes that you'll get in your local food markets, they're bred for transportation. So you lose out mm-hmm. on the shapes and colors and taste of heirloom tomatoes, for example. And so farmers markets provide a way for customers to come to meet the producers, to hear the stories behind the producers, to eat seasonally, to eat really good food. And the best part is, in general, it's actually much more affordable.
Yeah, you can really get a good deal.
Yeah, yeah.
You can get great produce for such a good price. There's been an increase, too, in the number of customers or markets, rather, that take SNAP or EBT cards.
Yes, and we're actually DIG Local Network. Both the markets that we run at the beach, we're proud to offer SNAP and EBT access. We have folks come to both markets. They'll swipe their card. They get some tokens, and they can go out and actually purchase fresh produce and goods. And the cool thing is, too, we also are part of the FOGS initiative, Fresh Access Bucks, which doubles up on any tokens that are used for Florida-grown produce. So you can come and get two for one, basically.
Yeah, and particularly when we're dealing with this issue of food deserts, too, in large sections of this community, this is a way for people to get access to fresh produce that they might not otherwise
Yes.
Have.
Yeah. In general, farmers markets so far that I have found are located a little bit more proximity to neighborhoods. So it becomes a much easier thing for folks to be able to walk to the market, to get there, to get home with their groceries. So yeah, in combating food deserts, farmers markets are essential.
Now you hold public office out at the beaches, but you are also affiliated with Dig Local Network. Mm-hmm. What is Dig Local Network?
So we started years back following a community garden project in Atlantic Beach. And since then, we've acquired several projects, including the two farmers markets. We're at two community gardens and multiple educational programs. But basically, our goal is to sort of facilitate and provide access to people to good food. And we think that happens best through farmers markets, through community gardens, and then even just through education. Mm-hmm. Some folks don't realize the benefit of a healthy, balanced diet. Some people don't realize that they can supplement their grocery bill by growing perhaps on their property or in a community garden. And yeah, so that's Dig. We're trying to get you to dig everything local.
Dig local. And there are so many local options, as I said, for farmers markets. If you like Riverside Arts Market, great. If you check out the farmers market over on Beaver Street, just west of downtown, that is an amazing farmers market. It is the oldest one in Florida, by the way. And I know I'm forgetting some other ones, but there's also the Beaches Green Market and Midweek Market mm-hmm. out at the beach. They do not only a lot of produce, there's seafood, there's beauty and wellness products, all kinds of cool stuff. And coming up on August 18th, something's going to be happening out there. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, we're going to have, I believe it's First Act. They're going to come. We call it the Sprouts program, but basically we want the market to be sort of a super inclusive event for parents and for kids. And so we invite folks, especially nonprofits, to come in and sort of set up a table and a tent to do activities or arts and crafts with the kids. So it becomes a really fun moment where parents can come, their kids can do something fun while parents are grabbing groceries. And yeah, just a good time for the whole family.
Yeah, people need to come out to that. And by the way, one other point to make about Farmers Market Week. Agriculture is one of the biggest drivers of Florida's economy. So when you go to a farmer's market, you're supporting Florida's small farmers. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know this statistic. More than 80% of all direct market food sales occur within 100 miles of a farm.
Yeah.
So the idea is to buy as close to where it was grown as possible.
Yes. And that's pretty easy in Florida. We've got a lot of space and our growing season is almost never ends.
I know, exactly. More than $710 million in sales at farmers markets last year. That is just amazing.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. I think the movement to shop local, to investigate what's close to you, and it's a significant portion of the market. So
now, again, the Beaches Green Market is every weekend, rain or shine. Riverside Arts Market, of course, every Saturday under the Fuller Warren Bridge. The Beaver Street Market open every day of the year, I think, just about. So you've got lots of choices. Get out and support a farmer's market this week and this weekend. Brittany Norris is with Dig Local Network, and we thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
In a moment, some ideas for your weekend. Also, a special opportunity for creatives via the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville. We're going to tell you about that, too. So, quick break and keep listening.
A1A Solar designs and installs residential and commercial solar electric systems. NABCET certified A1A Solar provides sustainable and financially efficient energy solutions. Learn whether solar is right for you with a 5-question quiz at a1asolar.com.
a day of health and wellness designed for you. Join WJCT and Baptist Health at A Day for Her, Saturday, August 18th at the Hyatt Hotel. For more information or to purchase tickets, log on to wjct.org/events. On the next Fresh Air, how the Trump administration radicalized ICE. We talk with Franklin Foer. His new article, How ICE Went Rogue, is the cover story of the new edition of The Atlantic. The article is also about the booming industry of private detention centers for immigrants rounded up by ICE. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
NASA is about to launch a new spacecraft to probe the sun. The mission is named after 91-year-old Eugene Parker, who will be there to see it blast off.
It's my first rocket launch, so it'll be very interesting.
Also, as fires burn through the West, there's a fight over whether utilities should have to pay when their equipment kicks off the fire. Those stories this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Did Charlottesville change anything? And if it didn't, how do you feel about that? Lives were lost at a rally that pitted white nationalists and neo-Nazis against counter-protesters. The president blamed both sides. Discord and American identity, next time on 1A. Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. The Cultural Council is holding an entrepreneur symposium for creatives next week at the Ritz Theater. And the council's Patrick Fisher says this is a big opportunity and it will sell out. Patrick, what's going to be happening?
Well, thanks so much for having me today. Yes, next weekend we have our annual entrepreneur symposium, Every Artist is a Small Business, which is sponsored by Community First Cares Foundation. This is the second year we've done the event, and we realized that there is a need for professional development within our artist community, not so much in development of how they create art, but in how they introduce and sell their art to their audience. So it's a full day of intensives where we have experts come in and speak about the business side of being an artist. And that is at the Ritz. It's all day. And we just found out yesterday that the $10 or $15 registration now also includes a complimentary lunch from Nacho Taco.
So oh, there you go.
It's a lot of bang for your buck.
So people need to register now for this event coming up, not this Saturday, but next Saturday.
Yes, Saturday the 18th. We do recommend registering in advance. Last year, our capacity was 100. We sold out at like 125. This year, now that we're at the Ritz, our capacity is 150. So people can register at the event, but we do encourage them to do it online.
Go to culturalcouncil.jax.org.
Culturalcouncil.org/ Community First.
And are grants coming in with this too?
Yes. Yeah, so this year, actually, Community First doubled their pledge. Last year, they committed $5,000 in individual artist grants. This year, they doubled that and committed $10,000. So that has been broken down into two grant cycles, one this summer and then one in the fall. They've already selected five recipients to be awarded $1,000 individual artist grants at the symposium. Mm-hmm. The really interesting thing about that is, you know, these funding options are really important because our artists don't have that many funding options here regionally. So with $5,000 in grants, we had 115 artists apply. I think that if this was any other city, you wouldn't see that type of turnout as far as application is concerned, because $1,000 is not that large of an amount. So to see that type of response shows the amount of support that our artists in our community truly need.
So register now. This is a great opportunity. If you're a creative and you need some professional development advice, opportunity to win a grant from Community First Cares Foundation, go to culturalcouncil.org. Be part of their Every Artist is a Small Business Symposium next Saturday. Patrick Fisher, always good to see you.
Always my pleasure.
Again, that's next weekend. Finally, this hour, what else is going on for the next couple of weekends? take us all around the town, we welcome the mistress of mayhem, the maven of mirth, the wildly dancing and gesticulating Carrie Speckman.
I thought you were going to say jazzercise.
They look like jazz hands.
I was kind of. I love that song. It just makes
you
want
to. That's your theme
makes
song.
Makes you want to dance.
Everybody needs a theme song.
Exactly.
You know?
You got that.
And you've
sister.
Got, yeah, you've got it, sister. Okay, so what? So tonight is the first preseason game for the Jaguars.
They are playing the New Orleans Saints. It's also the opening of that doggy park.
Pet Paradise
doggy park. That should be interesting.
I know, right?
They have to get there 3 hours early.
To bring their dog?
Yes, and they leave an hour after the game's over.
Is it really? Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I would do that, but I'm sure a lot of people will.
I think it's kind of, it's cute. A novelty.
Yeah, it's cute.
It's a novelty.
All right, so
I'm a cat person. What do I know?
yeah, you are. But it's going to be a great night at the bank.
Is that what they're calling it now?
That's what they're calling it now.
Okay.
To take on the Saints. And then Saturday, the Axemen are playing over at UNF.
And this is the South Championship final. And if they win this, they go to the national championship. Dun, dun, dun.
Good luck to them.
Yes.
All right. Saturday. I want to mention this quickly because you put this on your list. Todd Rundgren is coming.
Easy for you to say.
To the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall next Thursday. I love him. I've always liked him.
Are you going to go see him?
Well, I don't go to anything,
that's
as you
true.
Know.
You
so,
don't.
But that's going to be a great concert.
For those who do go.
Yes.
Okay.
Go see Todd Rundgren.
And his progressive rock.
Next Thursday, Ponte Vedra Concert Hall. Next Friday, Jason Mraz coming to, where's he playing?
He is at Daly's Center.
Oh, at Daly's Place.
Daly's Place.
Okay. And then let's talk about another local favorite of ours, the great Mama Blue.
I love her.
One of the greatest singers around.
Love her.
They're having a big thing for her next Saturday at Crispy's in Springfield.
Well, it's Crispy's first anniversary.
Oh, it's celebrating Crispy's.
Or birthday. I don't know what a restaurant has, a birthday or an anniversary, but it's their anniversary, and she's
the headliner.
And she's going to be performing, and anytime you can see Mama Blue.
I may actually come out to that.
Would you?
I may be seeing you there.
I hope so.
Yeah, because of course you do trivia at Crispy's every Tuesday night.
And tonight I'll be doing trivia at European Street San Marco.
Is that a fact?
It is.
Go out and see The Spectator tonight in San Marco and next Saturday the 18th at Crispy's in Springfield as they celebrate 1 year in business. That Main Street corridor in Springfield is just taking off.
I have to give a shout out to Dennis Chan at Blue Bamboo because he is one of five semifinalists in the General Mills recipe contest.
Oh, kudos to Dennis.
Go there and get his Sunshine State Orange Crunch Cake. And you will be very happy you did.
That sounds really good, actually. And go to thespectator.com for a list of full events. 1A's up next. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back tomorrow at 9 a.m. with our Friday Media Roundtable. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.